Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I am Donna Prisgintas.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. We get together here once a week, Tuesdays at noon, at the KHOI studios and have a fine old time. We talk about food, we talk about farming, advice, opinions, all sorts of things. It's winter. It's cold. Hope you're all happy and well out there. According to my handy-dandy pagan book of days, this is St. Hilary's Day, really, truly. So if you're already thinking of the upcoming election, clam onto this day, St. Hilary's Day. She's only one of many.
Hillary's, that is.
Hillary's, right, right. And if you wish to, also the handy pagan book of days tells me that if you wish to channel your inner druid, today is the day to honor the fruit trees. Sing, dance, raise a glass of cider for a good harvest this coming year. And all around the world, despite the awful things that have been happening in the news, there are good things happening. People are marching in solidarity with the people of France and people of violence all over for peace and understanding and goodwill to all. So wish us all of that out there. That's good, too. Besides being cold and winter, it's citrus season.
In the warmer climes.
In the warmer climes. But that means, thanks to the bounty of shipping food all over the place, our grocery stores have citrus in them. So we're going to consider the lemon today. And we also have later a visit from Mary Swander. So, Donna, what can you tell us about lemons?
Well, I'm going to get the bad news out of the way, first of all. In most of the citrus-growing parts of this country, which would be Florida, Texas, California, there has been some sort of, and I'm not a good biologist, but there's some sort of devastating disease that's going on. So all the citrus growers are just having a very difficult time. And this has been going on a few years, I don't know, 3 or 4 years, and it's not quite under control yet. So you will see a declining amounts of inexpensive citrus. The prices are definitely higher this year. I've noticed usually about this time of year I can go to like Hy-Vee and buy a 10-pound bag of grapefruits and go home and just get out my electric juicer, you know, the citrus, those kind that just grind it really easily, specifically for citrus. Can't live without one of those because you can really blitz through a lot of it and get fresh juice. And I love doing that this time of year. Well, those terrific deals where you get these big bags for $6 or $7 or something have not been happening yet. So, and may not happen. I don't really know.
That's right. In past years, I remember high school groups like band members or the FFA groups would order up citrus deals for Christmas. You could get big bags of citrus for Christmas and help out those folks. And I haven't seen a lot of that going on. So
no. And I'm noticing lemons and limes are pretty pricey for this time of year. So that's the bad news. The good news is, yes, we still do have them, even though all of these wonderful little midwinter zesty vitamin C treats are going to be, I think, more expensive. So here we go.
Yes, yes. There's all kinds, besides lemons, there's all kinds of citrus. And I pretty much just grab and eat whatever is there, but there's navel oranges, Valencia oranges, clementines, satsumas oranges, and tangerines, and blood
and
oranges.
And lots of kinds of tangerines.
And blood oranges. Nothing set me back like the first time I cut through a blood orange and realized the inside was red. What a good idea.
Aren't they beautiful?
But it's a shocker because oranges are supposed to be orange, no? But oranges are not always
orange.
Well,
there's the pink grapefruit.
It's been around for a while. And I've just also I have discovered recently not just a lemon, but there's something called Meyer lemon, and they've been around for a while too.
Meyer, right?
Meyer lemon, right? Yes. They have a slightly smoother skin than a normal lemon,
and thinner also.
Yeah, thinner skin. They're a bit more delicate and they're lovely and sweet.
Well, sweet for a lemon.
Sweet for a lemon.
They're
yeah.
still tangy, but they are sweeter than a normal lemon.
They,
but they're interchangeable in recipes.
Right. It is named after somebody named Frank Meyer. So there we go. It's an agriculturist who found the plant in China in the early 20th century. And studying it, he determined that it was probably a cross between...
with some orange in it?
But maybe a mandarin orange or something. But it's been around. This is not genetic engineering modern stuff here. This has been crossed ages ago.
And it's delicious.
And it's a whole separate variety of lemon called a Meyer lemon.
And they're usually quite juicy also.
Actually, I made a I had some. I bought some. And I made a Meyer lemon tart, which was very nice. Surprisingly, I followed the recipe. I went online and went in. I got up good old Martha Stewart's recipe. It was just a little custard in a little tart pan, and it didn't call for much sugar at all, and egg yolks and a little sugar.
So it's really a lemon curd recipe.
A lemon curd. It was a lemon curd
in a
recipe.
Pastry shell,
right? And it wasn't as tart. It was very sweet. It was lovely. Because I was surprised. It didn't call for much sugar at all, and I enjoyed my Meyer lemon tart.
Which is similar to your grandmother's meringue pie, lemon meringue pie, another classic, without the meringue.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Good time for lemons. Something I've been working on is a preserved lemons. If you have – they're traditionally considered – well, they're very Mediterranean – ergo Middle Eastern foods and things like that. But you can use them not just in your couscous and things like that, but also in pastas, chopped up on fish, chopped up with herbs as a garnish for steak or chicken, dropped into salads. I mean, they have a lot of use. They're delicious in an olive dish. Anything that have olives, you can put them.
So, I've run across a recipe or two that are called for preserved lemons. Then looking back, it sounded like quite a process. Preserved lemons sounds like a good idea, but traditionally I would say, oh, preserve. Okay, does that mean like canning them? Does that mean like pickling them?
Salting them.
And looking back in the traditional recipes, they seem quite a fuss.
I have a trick.
Oh, I'm so glad you have a trick. There's something to do because traditionally it would be layering them in salt and let them
you layer them in salt and a little water, and then you turn the jar upside down every other day to kind of make it go back and forth, and you let it go for a month. And, you know, you can stick herbs and bay leaves and stuff like that. And I have done that. It's always a little iffy. I'm not a total success at that. So I found another way to do it.
Good
for
you.
Which I'm thrilled with. It came in a book called Ideas in Food by Aki Karamozawa and Alexander Talbot. These guys are really into molecular gastronomy, which I am mostly not because I like to keep it a little more simple. But they do have this methodology for making preserved lemons, which I like a lot. I'll just read you what they say. Preserved lemons should be in everybody's pantry. They taste like sunshine, adding bright acidity and color to a dish. We often mince them and use them as a seasoning to enrich pan sauces for fish or meat or flavored pastas. Thinly sliced and fried, they can go sweet or savory. Chopped with fresh garlic and parsley, they make a wonderful replacement for this classic gremolata, which is you chop fresh parsley and, let's see, the traditional is lemon zest, fresh parsley, and very finely minced garlic. Toss them together and you can sprinkle it on lots of things like fish, chicken, that sort of thing. So they also say these are for preserved lemons. You can also slide them under the skin of your roast chicken for amazing lemon chicken. Here is the technique. They say 4 organic lemons. Now, I do like to use organic when I'm doing anything with zest because you are eating the skin. This is supposed to make about a quart. So you take 4 organic lemons and you wash them and dry them. You slice off the ends and then you cut them into 1/8-inch slices and pick out the seeds. Then that's what you would do, I think, for a normal preserved lemon. Now the easy part comes. You put them into you put them in a bowl and you toss them with a teaspoon of fine sea salt and a teaspoon of sugar. So they're kind of all coated in that. And then you can put them either in a vacuum pack bag, which is you know, very molecular gastronomy-ish. Or you could put them in a Ziploc bag and suck the air out.
That's even
Do you know
easier.
That technique?
That's even easier.
Yeah, it's you slide the zipper almost closed, and then you put your lips to it, and you, instead of blowing out, you suck it in. So they kind of shrivel with the, you know, the bag shrivels up really nice and tight, and then you quickly zip it shut. So you've got the salt, sugar, and lemons in the bag. You put it in the freezer anywhere from 8 to 24 hours. You take it out and put it in the refrigerator and let it completely thaw. Then you put it back into the freezer for another 8 or 24 hours. Then you put it back into the refrigerator to thaw. Now, what this is doing is freezing breaks down the cell walls. So, you know, you're going expansion, contraction, and that lets the salt and sugar in. And then the third time, let's see, after you've frozen it twice and thawed it, then you put the 2/3 cup of olive oil into the bag, mix it all up, reseal it with the sucking the air out method, put it back into the freezer for the third time, let it freeze 8 to 24 hours, then you take it out and put it in the fridge and it's done.
Oh, and you store it in the fridge after that?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I always keep mine in the fridge anyway.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Because I can grow odd things.
It doesn't need it, or you can leave it in the freezer?
You know, I would think you could until you're ready to use it and thaw it for the third time, because this one says the lemons are ready to use or they can be stored in the refrigerator covered in olive oil for up to a month.
Cool.
So
yeah.
In this time when it is citrus season and we do get hopefully less expensive, it could be a preservation method and you could actually have bags of these, in, I would think, in the freezer for a long period of time and then take them out. You know, then thaw them as you want to use them.
I'm going to give this a try. So you end up with soft chunks of lemon. They're still recognizable as chunks of lemon?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh,
it's a softening technique, and it's like you can buy preserved lemons in the store, but the canned ones never taste quite right to me. I have gotten them even in olive bars like at the Gateway or something like that. And they're okay, but these are really good. Oh, another thing I love to do it when I make homemade hummus, I put the preserved lemons in and grind them up in the hummus.
Ooh, now that sounds
good. It is good. It's very, very good. And there's lots of other things you can do with them. So this is it's a really simple trick.
Oh, good.
It takes a little time. But it's like, oh, put it in the freezer, take it out of the freezer, put it, you know, it's like.
Yeah. We can do that.
We hope
and
so.
And as opposed to this microgastronomy, what was it called?
Molecular gastronomy.
I've been reading a little bit about this molecular gastronomy stuff. It calls for super freezing and boiling. And
immersion, thermometer, water bath things, and very high techie. But this particular book that I mentioned, Ideas in Food, subtitle Great Recipes and Why They Work, is actually, I'll loan it to you. It's a molecular gastronomy light. It really explains why things work. So
good.
Interesting.
You loaned me that book. I have a book that I've been reading, too. A friend passed along this book to me, and I consider it really a fun read. It's about food anthropology, actually. It's called Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat by someone named Bee Wilson. She's a food writer and a cultural anthropologist from Cambridge, England. This book is a real fun read. It considers how in the world human beings ever got around to figuring out that putting things over a fire would help, etc. It goes through everything from pots and pans to knives to fire to ice, how we grind, how we measure. We haven't always done things the same way.
Nor will we continue to always do
right.
things the same
Nor
way.
Nor will we continue.
So I bet she says something about lemons.
She does say something about lemons. In the chapter about knives, about how we cut things up, that's a great chapter. It has to do with how we saved our teeth by actually being able to cut things up. For many, many, many centuries, going from sharp sticks to stones to bronze to copper to all that stuff, we got into steel blades, which did us pretty well for a long time, and people used daggers and knives to cut things, and we're doing fine. But the steel blades would turn absolutely black and bring some really awful, awful flavors to the food if any kind of acid hit them. So cutting lemons was really a problem, or anything else that would have acid in it. So for centuries, the really rich households had special fish knives and special lemon knives that were made out of silver. So if you could handle a silver knife, it could afford a silver knife, that was good. Otherwise, you just ended up with a very corroded blade, and that was not good. So the launch of stainless steel in the 20th century ranks as one of the great additions to the happiness of the table. So now, after we have stainless steel, we can finally cut our lemons and other acidic things without
pickles.
Without having this black, awful taste happening. Stainless steel went into cheap mass production after World War II. It first was invented in World War I as part of the war effort. It was made for, they were looking for better gun barrels.
I'm not surprised.
Of course. It's kind of like inventing Tang because we went to the moon. You know, we move along. So in lieu of gun barrels, someone in England named Harold Brierley of Thomas Firth and Son discovered the stainless steel alloy, and non-corrosive cutlery was a happy byproduct of the search for a military advantage between Britain and Germany on the road to war. So there you go. It seems a pretty small thing now, but stainless steel lets us attack our lemons with zeal. And like I said, that's from a book named Consider the Fork, A History of How We Cook and Eat by B. Wilson.
I'm going to introduce a third book.
Oh, good.
This
about
is
lemons.
The Flavor Thesaurus, A Compendium of Pairings, Recipes, and Ideas for the Creative Cook. And it's Nikki Signet, Signit. And under lemons, she mentions a lot of different pairings and lemon and chili, lemon and chicken, lemon and caviar, capers, broccoli, lemon and dill, lemon and eggs. Now, under lemon and eggs, she really hit upon one of my favorites, and this is a kind of a cold weather trick. I've lost the place. Well, anyway, I'll tell you what it is. It's avogomundo soup, which is a Greek kind of thing. So it's chicken soup, as you would any chicken soup. And then you take you take a couple of eggs and you mix them with lemon juice in a cup. And then you start to add a little broth. And then you kind of swirl them gradually into the pot. So you get these strings of eggs bits. And it's also called lemon egg. It's like a lemon egg drop soup, but this is the Greek version. So you end up with eggs in your broth or your chicken soup or they do it with rice rather than chicken noodle, but you can do it any way you want. But the egg and lemon make a really nice hearty soup, and you get the twirls of the egg and then the bright lemony flavor, and then I always add a little Greek oregano and a spit of Aleppo pepper.
Oh.
And that's a really good, chicken soup for when you have a cold or anything like that.
Oh, chicken soup. Yes.
Chicken lemon.
Oh, say the name again.
Avogomundo.
Oh, that doesn't that sound good
Something
to
Something like that. The other thing that she mentions, which is a favorite to me, is lemon and chocolate.
Oh.
Now, they are making, lemon chocolate bars and things like this, but the classic that's lemon and coffee. That's what I mean. Lemon and coffee. Lemon and chocolate is excellent also. Or you were saying candied orange candied lemon peel dipped in chocolate is really wonderful. But the classic Italian is not a cappuccino, but if you take an espresso, deep, dark, rich espresso, it is often served with a lemon peel. And the peel is cut specifically, about a half an inch to 3/4 inch wide and maybe an inch and a half long, enough that you can take it between your fingers and you kind of hold it over the espresso cup and twist it so that the oils come out of the – because this is what you're after in lemons is the volatile oils in the skin. And you'll see them spritz right into the cup, and then you can drop the lemon peel actually in the cup. So you get this – bitter coffee flavor with this lemony tang, and it's really delicious.
Now, that's a flavor that I wouldn't have thought of. Somehow, lemon and chocolate. Oh, I can imagine that, and I've actually had that. But lemon and coffee.
It's not with cream or sugar or anything.
Okay. So it's not a sweet thing.
No, it's straight espresso. Okay. And it's very widely seen in Italy.
Oh, goodness. So you ask for a shot of lemon or a little
twist. Actually, often if you just get straight espresso, they will automatically serve it with the
What to do with it. I wouldn't think it would be a mistake. Thank you for that bit of advice. I feel ever so much
more. Yeah, aren't we sophisticated?
Oh,
here?
This is good. So write all this stuff down out here.
Okay, this is a bit more on the sad side about lemons. You know, as I lived in California many, many years, I used lemons and all kinds of citrus and everything and the skins and the zest. And, you know, it was just heavenly. So when I moved to Iowa, I discovered that, you know, my recipes were not working the same way here because the zest was not as pungent. So what happens as the lemons, grapefruits, oranges, as they travel that far, they lose some of their volatile oils in the skin. Mm. So, you know, sometimes you can use more, but that always doesn't do it because you've really lost a lot of that volatile oil in the skin. So my little trick is I purchase online sort of lemon oil, and orange oils and tangerine oils and grapefruits. I keep them in my fridge. They're little tiny dropper bottle kinds of things.
They look very medicinal, the little
they
dropper
are,
bottles.
They are, and they are also, people use them for aromatherapies and stuff like that, but you can buy edible quality, and then sometimes I put those into dishes where I'm not getting the oomph. So if you're using recipes that call for citrus zest, and it's not as pronounced as it would be because here in Iowa we don't really grow citrus, so it has to travel to get here. Sometimes a bit of those volatile oils in the little jar will work as well.
Oh, good.
Or in addition to, I would say.
Right. So beware of the strength of those oils.
Oh, yeah. Go easy. They do come out a drop at a time.
Yes. Very good. I want to remind you, you are listening to KHOI. Radio 89.1, and also remind you that support for this radio show comes from Wheatsfield Co-op, your full-service natural foods grocery in Ames. Community-owned, community-focused since 1974, open daily 7 to 9. Located downtown at 413 Northwestern, just off Main Street in Ames. Everyone can shop Wheatsfield Co-op. We'll have a little music to go to listen here. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen here on KHOI Radio. Here in central Iowa, there are many stories to tell. Mary Swander, Iowa Poet Laureate, and many other good things here in central Iowa, joins us here to read a bit from her new one-woman play. Her one-woman play is called The Map of My Kingdom. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's about?
Well, originally this was commissioned by Practical Farmers of Iowa to talk about inheritance issues, specifically farm inheritance, because there's a huge percentage of land changing hands. And if people don't plan and are not aware of it, and of course, no one wants to think about dying and what's going to happen. So there's a lot of avoidance around these issues. But it does lead to catastrophe and calamity. Of course, the person who's dead doesn't have to deal with it, but everyone else does. So Teresa Opheim at Practical Farmers of Iowa commissioned Mary Swander to write this play about these issues. And it's a one-woman show being performed a lot of places around the mm-hmm, state. Mm-hmm. And it will be sort of the keynote at the Practical Farmers of Iowa conference, which is the 23rd or 24th or something like that.
Coming up later this week.
Here at the Scheman Auditorium.
Yeah. So we had Mary come into the studio, and she'll read a bit about her play. It's a one woman telling her story, but this story is made up of a lot of other stories.
Do you know how my grandmother Millie sold her farm? I just heard this story a few months ago. I remember getting this out-of-the-blue news from my mom that Grandma sold the farm. But I never heard how she went about doing it till just a while back. And it was only recently that I began to understand why my grandmother sold the farm exactly like she did. Carl Hubert told me this story. One Saturday morning, when Grandma Millie was around 80 years old, she knocked on his door. His farm was next to hers, and she pulled into his driveway in her 41 Ford. And, "Carl? Carl?" she said. "I'm selling my farm, and you're the buyer." She laid out the terms on contract, such and such and such per acre, real top dollar. And Carl, he's standing there not knowing what hit him, she's just Hurricane Millie, you know. "Carl, your father and my father immigrated and homesteaded this land. We farmed side by side for years, and you and I have worked together as neighbors all of our lives. We've seen a lot of harvests, a lot of threshing crews." And Carl's nodding but can't get a word in edgewise as Millie is just, "The Hubers have always been good farmers, and I know you'll take good care of the land. And then your sons will do the same after you." And Carl said he told her the price was a little steep, fair, but a little steep. And he told her he didn't really need another farm, and the boys were already set up, and Millie, "I've already had my lawyer draw up the papers. And they are all ready. We'll sign them Monday morning. With that price." Carl shook her hand, and Grandma Millie told him to meet Monday morning to sign the papers. And Carl did. A while back, I saw my own family's farm in Ireland. All this clicked for me. I looked out over the land with my cousin, and she told me this story. The ancestral farm was 80 acres, but pure rock. Only 20 acres were actually tillable. And that soil, that 20 acres of arable turf, they cut that up for fuel and literally burnt through all their farmland. So the farmers went down to the ocean, hauled up these large baskets of seaweed and kelp from the beach, and laid it across the rocks and the barren scars. After years and years of composting what they were pulling out of the ocean, that soil became tillable. And when my ancestors came here, they actually had great soil, but they burnt through it just the same. And when the Dust Bowl came, well, there wasn't a lot of seaweed here.
That was Mary Swander reading from her new play, Map of My Kingdom. She's also going to talk to us about an organization that just makes sense. It's called Ag Arts, the meeting of agriculture and arts.
Okay, we have Mary Swander with us here in the studio, and she's going to talk about something that she and Fred Kirschman have cooked up that began in our community and is going to be going nationally, or is going nationally. It's called Ag Arts. Mary, you want to explain what that is?
Sure. Ag Arts is an art organization that's designed to imagine and promote healthy food systems through the arts. And it started right here on the ISU campus. As you said, Fred Kirschman and I started the group. And it's a student organization, but it reaches out to the community. There are lots and lots of people that are members that are in Ames and beyond. On one of the meetings, I had a farmer drive 200 miles to come and tell me he had a theater in his barn that was there waiting to be used. And so it's a group of writers, theater artists, visual artists, dancers, any kind of
chefs,
culinary arts,
radio artists,
anyone interested in engaged in the arts who's also interested in agriculture.
And now we have other chapters around.
We start with the Iowa chapter, and they have a Facebook page that's called Ag Arts Iowa. And now we're moving into a national scene. And there's a Facebook page that just says Ag Arts. And if you just search for that, AGARTS.
Is it one word or hyphenate?
It's one word.
Okay.
And you'll find all sorts of doings, and I'd love for people to post on the timeline there. And so we're branching out. We're working on a website. We're eventually going to launch that and try to touch people across the country, because this group's been very successful in Ames, Iowa.
Talking about farming experience with the land, experience with food through the arts is a wonderful idea. How else can we tell our story?
And who would know better than Lana Nachtigal?
Yeah, you're the epitome of our
arts. The former artist.
I started out as an artist, always have been, turned into a musician just because I really like that too, turned into a dancer because I like that too. Then I turned into a farmer. And
right.
It's all the same big pile of stuff. And it's so nice to have the Ag Arts organization. You've been an inspiration and a good source of a lot of things.
Nice
thing that has come out of this gathering, and what came out of your work at the university too, are these plays that tell stories. Map of My Kingdom is the latest one, but there's been other ones too.
And the stories are of farming and the culture of farming.
That's right.
And we the culture of farming has become a sort of a hot topic these days, culturally and nationally.
And it has. And when I started
aren't
out,
cute, the hayseeds out here in Iowa.
Then when I started out, the first play in this vein was Farmscape, and I toured that all around the Midwest, out to New York, out to Denver. One of the most rewarding things was that audience was filled with farmers. And where do you see theater, like that? And
yeah, the farmers don't go to the theater, right?
Well, with the whole audience full of farmers,
which
is really
great.
And they, after the show, I'd have a talk back discussion, and inevitably farmers would get up and say, oh, thank you. For once, we see ourselves portrayed mm-hmm. realistically mm-hmm. In the media on the stage.
And as opposed to this television show called The Bachelor Farmer or the Sexy Bachelor Farmer. Oh, boy, oh, boy.
The Reality Farmer show. There was a lot of sexually bachelor farmers, but they're not like they're on TV. So get out here and meet the real folks. Telling stories, you think that your story isn't much, but tell it to somebody else and listen to mm-hmm. somebody else's story. You realize what a wonderful human experience we have, and these experiences of farm and food connect up with the rest of us.
That's right.
Everybody else eats. Everybody else is part of this great big production.
The second show I did was called Vang, which is about immigrant farmers. I just love the misconceptions, that people have. And immediately when I tell people that I was working on this, they'd say, all right, Mary, where'd you go to get the immigrants? California? And I said, no, I went in a 50-mile radius of Ames, Iowa. The show has portraits of Hmong farmers, Sudanese farmers, Mexican farmers, and Dutch farmers, all recent immigrants to the United States, all with their citizenship, all legal. You know, that was the other thing. One of the first shows we did was in Des Moines, and the first response was, "Oh, wow, I thought all immigrants were illegal." And, you know, and this was a very intelligent audience, you know. And I was at the Unitarian Church.
You wonder how all us white folk got here. We must have been illegal at one time, too, because we all are in the same pot now. It's a lovely story. The individual stories make the bigger issues much more real.
And Map of My Kingdom is about farmland transition, or who's going to get the farm, which is a huge issue across the country, actually around the world. When I travel,
eternally,
always. You know, when I travel, people say, that's how we ended up, you know, in poverty, because the farms got divided in Europe and it's smaller and smaller, and then they get sucked up by the lords, and you know, it's a whole different system, sort of. But we have our own.
Yeah, we have our own equivalent here, I'm afraid.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but besides families dividing things up, there's the urban creep that sort of divides things up for us, whether we want a shopping mall on our place or not. They tend to be next door sometimes. There's a lot of land issues. You think the Midwest, you think Iowa, we got lots of room. Well, we also have the really good farmland that we should treasure and make sure.
And that everybody wants.
No, that's exactly right. And so the show covers urban sprawl, which is a huge issue. You know, I just cringe every time I see good Iowa farmland.
Put up a parking lot.
Yeah, plowed over for a parking lot.
Well, it's back to the old eternal themes of death and taxes.
That's exactly it. And there's also the issue of, you know, really how are we going to preserve this land in a way that will be productive for generation after generation, you know. Oftentimes, a family, when they're working on this issue, if at all, there's an amazing number of people who haven't even thought about it and who are over 65 years old. They think, what's the best way so future generations don't have to pay tax? Well, that's one consideration. But the other
on the inheritance.
Right.
Yeah.
And the other consideration is, what are your goals for the property? What would you like to see happen in the future to support those generations that are to come?
Another consideration that I'm afraid is way on the back burner, but what is good for the land? The absolute pleasure or the absolute privilege of being able to say, I can make a difference with this piece of land.
Right. And steward it.
Not just save money on taxes, but stewardship is a good thing, too.
Yeah. When I was writing the play, you know, when you're working on a project like this, you just get very, very deep into it. And after about 3 months of writing, I thought, really, the question here is, do we really own the land? Who owns this land? Mm-hmm. You know, and that has all sorts of ramifications socially, politically, spiritually.
So we're glad that The Map of My Kingdom is your latest work, and it will be performed at the Practical Farmers of Iowa Annual Conference, and that's coming up January 23rd.
Maybe it's cold outside.
Yes, and it's coming up the end of January.
So here in Ames is it the Sheman Building?
Right.
And for more information on the Practical Farmers Conference coming up, contact Practical Farmers, www.practicalfarmers.org. Spell all that out, practicalfarmers.org, and you'll get some information.
Download the brochure there that has the times for the play and the rest of the conference, which is really interesting. It's centered on land transition this year with many other topics involved, and then you can register right online.
Plus, Mary is having a lot of other performances all over the state coming.
It's fast and furious. Everybody's trying to get their performance in before planting season begins. So I actually have 15 shows coming up.
Is there a website where all of those shows are listed?
Yes, it's www.maryswander.com. And if you look under the events button, they're all listed there.
Oh, good, because there are a lot of really all over the states kind of local performances. Mm-hmm. all sponsored by very interested parties.
No, really. It's everyone from farmers, again, with spaces in their barn that they fixed up, to colleges and universities, so, and everything in between.
And so bankers,
bankers are interested in this, insurance
lawyers,
companies.
Yeah. Lawyers. This is an issue that we all need
That's
to deal
right.
with.
Accountants. This is an issue that if you've ever been in the situation, and I have, you know how tense it can be. And so when you mention, broach the subject to someone who's been there, people's eyes just light up and they go, whoa, yeah, no,
yeah.
That's a tough
inheritance.
One.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it could be inheritance of anything, really. I mean, there's farmland, which is a huge, huge issue in and
right.
of
Mostly
itself.
Mostly because
here.
It's worth so much money just
right.
these days.
Right. But you can have a family that I found a researcher at the University of Minnesota, and her research is families that fight over even minutia, like grandma's pipe tin, you know. So it can set a family.
Yes, we all have those
off.
Stories.
Yep.
We do.
Right.
Good.
And then their families actually give real thought to it, take good time, invest a lot of energy in it, talk to their whole family, discuss it with their offspring, and come up with some wonderful solutions.
So the play will help people to realize to plan a little in advance.
Start thinking about it. Mm-hmm. Right. Start talking about it. Start getting your goals down. I think it's really helpful. Many families sit down and create a mission statement for their farm and then begin to consult experts, start to gather your options.
But first, go see the play. It covers a lot. It's basically, Mary wrote it as it's a one-woman show.
Right.
And the main character is a woman lawyer that deals with these issues. And it's a monologue where
That's
she
right.
talks about different experiences that she's had. And it goes from the sublime to the quite funny.
Right.
And do go and see it.
Theatrically, I think a great piece for an actor. It is a dramatic monologue.
Mm-hmm.
It lasts an hour, and that actor takes on the roles of at least 20 people, and in various emotional tenors, from the very, very tragic, there's a murder that's portrayed in it, to the very funny, like, I always love farmer jokes, so there's a lot of farmer jokes in it.
So that's Map of My Kingdom. Thank you for being with us today, Mary Swander.
Thank you very much. What a pleasure.
You're listening to KHOI 89.1 in Ames, Iowa. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We get together and talk about food and farming and all kinds of things. Go to our Donna Lana Kitchen webpage, and you can find out more about us, a lot about past shows. We've got recipes there. There's a great picture of Donna and I, and there are some links to some videos. You can see Donna live and on screen doing polenta and other things. So visit our webpage there. You can go to khoifm.org. And go to the Donna Lana Kitchen page. And as you are traveling by that khoifm.org webpage, stop at the donate button, too, and support this radio station. We get by on your goodwill and your funds.
Memberships. Get a membership.
Memberships are good. We'll be listening to some more music from fiddle player Lissa Schneckenberger. Lisa Schneckenberger. Yes, that's her name. She's a wonderful fiddler. She came through Ames a few times, and I've got to meet her. A fine woman with a fiddle. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Donna's been in the kitchen, and she's been cooking up something for us. What have you got for us today, Donna?
Ta-da-da-da! Liver pate. Okay, liver, either you love it or you hate it. So I'm not going to argue about the merits of liver here. But if you like it, here's an opportunity. Most liver pate is usually made with chicken livers. And, you know, not that we don't have chicken livers here. We do. But we also have a lot of pork liver. Now, the pork liver is a little more strong in flavor than the chicken liver. But I was undaunted by that. And I thought, there's got to be a way to make pork liver pate. So a few years ago, I fuddled and fuddled until I got it. And here is the recipe. And we're going to have it in studio tasting. So, Rick and Lana, prepare yourselves for this. Do you like liver, Rick?
So-so.
Well, oh, good. And you, Lana?
I absolutely love liver.
Oh, good. All right.
So
These are the typical divisions here.
Keep that in mind.
Let me tell you what it is, and then we'll take a taste of it. So this makes two large loaves. You take a pound of bacon. I kind of just cut it up into not too small. It doesn't really matter. And 2 pounds of pork liver, 4 large red onions, a tablespoon of minced garlic, 12 bay leaves, 2 teaspoons of salt, 1/2 teaspoon of pepper, 2 teaspoons of sugar, 2 tablespoons of dried marjoram, 2 teaspoons of dried lovage, which only Lana and I possess.
I'm sure other people have
you,
it too.
You can't, but you can't buy it at the store.
Yeah,
so if you can't get it, you can leave it out. But and then ground juniper, 2 teaspoons. So basically what you do is you fry up the bacon and the onions, and then you put all the spices in the food mill, in the coffee grinder that I use, and you grind them up so that the bay leaves become powdered and the juniper is powdered in with it and the lovage and the marjoram and the sugar and the salt and the pepper. It's all powdered in there together. And the garlic you would put in with the onions. So you put the onions, the bacon, and all the spices in, and you fry it up till the onions are really soft and the bacon is, you know, all the grease has been rendered out. And then you put all of that into the Cuisinart food processor.
Including the grease.
Everything.
Yes.
Oh, yeah,
good.
Because you need the fat.
Need the fat. Got it.
Fat is part of the pate. So you put all of that in with the raw liver. That's with 1 pound of bacon and 2 pounds of pork liver.
Ah, raw liver. Got
raw
it.
Liver. All goes into the blender. It makes it, you know, you chop it really fine and it's a little liquidy, but not terribly. And then you have to put it through some kind of sieving process. And I use my, you know, my mother's ricer thing with the, what's it called?
Foley food mill?
Something like that.
Yeah,
any of those things.
Yeah.
So I push it through that. And then, of course, the dogs get the bits that don't go through it, and they are really happy.
Woof.
So then you put this into I just use bread pans or loaf pans. And then they must each be set in the oven, in a medium oven, 350, in another pan that has water in it. Mm. So it's a water bath kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So you put the liver in the loaf pan. You put the loaf pan in the baking pan. You bring the water up as high as it can go.
Do you have to put something under the loaf pan bottom?
No.
No. This just sits
right in there. Right in it.
Okay.
And you cook it till it's done, about an hour. You can see because it will it'll get firm to the touch kind of. Then you take it out and cool it. Mm-hmm. And then I make a little gelatin-topped apple-y thing that I pour over the top of it, like a little glaze that gives a – I mean, you can see it here.
There is a sample here,
yeah,
right in the studio.
It's got the shiny stuff on
and
the top.
It looks so much prettier. And pate is very lovely, but it kind of looks normally just kind of like tan stuff sitting there. But this has a really pretty glaze on the top.
Well, this is sort of an aspic layer on top of it, mm-hmm. and I do that by taking 2 cups of apple juice or cider, and you sprinkle 2 teaspoons of gelatin and kind of let it sit about 5 minutes while it dissolves. And then you heat it up with 2 teaspoons of sugar, 1 tablespoon of rice wine vinegar, pinch of salt, a little cinnamon, coriander, black pepper. And on this one, you can put some liquor in this one. What did I put in this one? Marsala, I think. But you can put port, you could put red vermouth, and then you kind of strain it to get the spices out. And once the pâté is cool enough, you just pour it over very thinly, like an eighth of an inch. Then you set it in the fridge to chill. And so here we have it. Now let's do the taste testing.
A very pretty thing.
All right,
a
I'm
very
cutting into
thing.
It, spreading it on a little cracker. Here you go, Lana. Rick. Rick is going to be brave and try the liver. What do you think?
I love liver. It's very aromatic with the spices. I like that.
Yeah.
Very low. And a little bit of sweet on the top.
Rick is nodding in the affirmative. He's not going, well, there's a little nose wrinkling here.
We had the bravest engineer in the whole world.
What do you think, Rick?
You know, I had to say, I haven't been disappointed with any of your cooking whatsoever yet. So
victory is mine.
This is a compliment. I thought I would be afraid of liver, but it's actually not bad with all the spices.
It's not bad.
That's high praise. That's high praise because it is a learned taste.
It's it's kind of like lunch meat in a way. Kind of tastes like it's
baby food.
Yeah, it's not bad really. I like
it's
this.
Very good. Yeah. A success. Fantastic. Will you be willing to put this on the website?
Yes, we will post a rough thing with all the measurements on the website. I guess I better write. Oh, yeah, I do have fry the bacon. Yes, we have
It's dandy.
We have it. We'll post it on the website.
I wouldn't have thought that pork liver could taste so good, although I like liver in any form. But I thought pâté might be a little strong, but it's not.
It is a little stronger than chicken liver, so that's why we put all those nice herbs in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mellows it out.
Oh, great.
And bacon, of course. Bacon makes everything good.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen with Lana Nachtigal.
And Donna Prisgintas.
With engineering and taste testing by Rick Morrison. We have the special guest, Mary Swander, talking about Ag Arts and the upcoming PFI conference. Mary read a little bit from Map of My Kingdom. We've been listening to the music of Lissa Schnechtenberger. Support KHOI. Support this radio station.
And eat liver pâté.
Eat liver pâté. It's winter. It's good for what ails you. Eat good food and enjoy life. Sparkly clean.